Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Members of Congress returned to Washington this week after a Thanksgiving recess that began in a most unfestive fashion, the failure of the Congressional Supercommittee to reach agreement on $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction. And as lawmakers reconvene, the question is, what now? The rules establishing the Supercommittee said if no accord was reached, $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts would kick in 2013, half to domestic programs and half to the military. The hope was this dire scenario would motivate members to make a deal by Thanksgiving. That didn't happen, but now some in Congress say they want to go back to the deficit drawing board before those reductions begin. Others, however, are already planning ways to get around the rules with bills to exempt favorite programs. Meanwhile, President Obama warns he'll veto any such measure, but the president himself has been criticized for staying quiet during the supercommittee process instead of playing a leadership role. And while all this posturing takes place inside the Beltway, outside, financial markets, business leaders, and the American public are looking askance at those elected to keep the nation's fiscal house in order, worrying that our rising debts and deficits may damage our still fragile economy. Today in The Exchange, after the super failure of the supercommittee, what happens next? We begin with Matt Laszlo. He's NHPR's correspondent in D.C. Hi, Matt. Thanks for your time.
Good morning.
Well, how does the failure, Matt, of the supercommittee change what's on Congress's agenda as it gets back together today?
Well, if anything, it increases the partisanship on Capitol Hill, which to many congressional observers, we say, no, that couldn't happen. The two parties are already at a pitched battle. It got even worse. This really soured the water. And so going forward, we're now in the midst of this election season. So both parties are going to really jockey to get the support from the extreme wings of their base, which for Democrats means shielding all entitlements from cuts. And for Republicans, we're seeing this already, trying to protect the Defense Department from these drastic cuts that were worked out in this deal. So if anything, the failure of the supercommittee brought the two parties further apart.
So we keep hearing that some members are going to look for ways to get around these automatic cuts that are supposed to now kick in 2013. What do those efforts look like, Matt, and will they succeed?
And that's the interesting thing. President Obama has put his line in the sand. He says he's going to veto any attempt to decrease that bottom line of $1.2 trillion in cuts. But already you have some Republicans saying they want to protect the Defense Department from these cuts. Defense Secretary Panetta said this would hollow out the forces. So you have contractors fighting. You have the military-industrial complex that we always hear about. They're fighting to protect their dollars and cents. And quite frankly, Democrats, and especially progressive Democrats, are kind of pleased with these cuts. This in the deal worked out, Medicare beneficiaries, they're protected from these cuts. So any cuts to Medicare would fall on doctors and providers. Also, Medicaid was protected from these cuts. So from a progressive standpoint, they're pretty pleased with the package. But going forward, you're going to see a lot of Republicans trying to unwind those cuts or at least change them. But in the atmosphere on Capitol Hill right now, that's going to be pretty hard because Democrats aren't going to want to give it all unless they get taxes on the table. And as we saw with the supercommittee, there's a little bit of an effort to do that on the Republicans' part, but not as much as Democrats wanted.
You know, Matt, you said that you expect the partisanship to increase because of the failure of the supercommittee. I have read, though, that some members of Congress are saying, OK, look, this is the signal that we really needed before this heavy budget axe falls on cherished domestic programs and the military. Let's all of us here in Congress get together. So are there members saying, look, this is the kick in the pants that we need, and now we're going to do our jobs?
Well, see, and even in the midst of the supercommittee process, we had both New Hampshire senators sign on with a bipartisan group of more than 40 senators saying they wanted a very large package in the $3 trillion range. So that was a bipartisan move forward. In the House, we had more than 100 Republicans and Democrats. It was about 60 Democrats and about 60 Republicans signed on to a deal saying we would even, for Republicans, they said we would even entertain tax increases as a part of the mix. It was actually stated as new revenues as a part of the mix, which in Washington is code for new taxes. So there were these efforts back then, but if you look at the numbers, it's only about a third and maybe a little less than a half of the Senate. So it's not the numbers to get it done. One thing we are seeing is there was this other group called the Gang of Six, which was a bipartisan group of senators who had worked out a $4 trillion package that included tax increases and changes to entitlements. There's talk of them getting back together. They're going to come up with a new proposal. But look at the math and look at the calendar. They came out with this a few months ago. It went nowhere. So now, if you're in the heart of this election season, why would lawmakers put their necks on the chopping block going forward? So
Well, especially since all these deficit commissions seem to get the reaction of thank you very much, but no. You know, you mentioned New Hampshire's delegation. So Senators Kelly Ayotte and Jeanne Shaheen both signed on to a bipartisan group of senators statement saying the supercommittee should go big, as it was said back then. Don't just go for $1.2 trillion, go for $3 to $4 trillion. That's one thing that happened in terms of New Hampshire, right, Matt?
Mm-hmm. And also it should be noted that Republican Congressman Charlie Bass, he also signed on to a similar effort in the House.
A similar effort, again, saying, okay, we could look at the possibility of new revenue. So there are some bipartisan murmurings. But, Matt, I'm kind of getting a negative vibe from you that anything is really going to happen on this before Congress lets out.
And as you in New Hampshire know better than I, we're in the heart of campaign season. The first caucus is January 3rd, and then New Hampshire's primary is right after that. And presidential politics is definitely playing into this, but also every House member is up for election next year, and so is a third of the Senate. So that really sours the water, and let's face it, our politicians in 2011 are very astute, and they know they're basically campaigning full-time. So it'll be interesting to see if any of them will break the mold. And one of the big criticisms of the supercommittee was that this was created by party leaders, and that party leaders are basically the puppet masters pulling the strings from behind the curtain. So if they're in control, they're looking at electoral gains, not necessarily deficit and a big solution.
Wow. Well, all right, Matt. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Matt Laszlo. He's NHPR's congressional correspondent, keeping an eye on New Hampshire delegation on Capitol Hill. Our number here on the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we look at what's ahead after the supercommittee's failure. Let's hear from you. Do you think this means we're a nation divided so badly that we'll never get our fiscal house in order? Or do you see this supercommittee failure providing the spark that it'll take to reduce our deficits and our national debt? Again, let's hear from you. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests for the hour. Eugene Sterley joins us from Washington. He's a fellow at the Urban Institute and a former Treasury Department official during four administrations, including economic coordinator of the Reagan tax reforms in 86. He also served as an advisor to President Obama's debt commission. Eugene's column is called The Government We Deserve. And Eugene, real nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Glad to be here, Laura.
Also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire is Matt Slaughter, Associate Dean of the MBA program and the Signal Company's professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. And Matt also served as an economic advisor in the George W. Bush administration. And Matt Slaughter, a big welcome back to you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Laura.
Well, and Matthew, you first, the supercommittee's super failure made for some great headlines and a lot of jokes about kryptonite. But in terms of our nation's finances, our economic health, Matthew, how big a deal is this really?
I think it is a big deal. I think the failure presents two problems, one immediate and one longer term. The immediate problem is there are a large number of tax and spending choices our country faces by the end of this calendar year, by December 31st. What to do with the payroll tax cut that was put into place last year, what to do with payments of unemployment insurance benefits, Medicare payments to doctors. So the supercommittee had been hoped for was going to address those things. It didn't. And we now have a lot more uncertainty facing companies and households throughout America about what's going to happen with fiscal choices in the very near term.
So that's the immediate term. Yeah, go ahead, Matthew.
That's the immediate term. And in the longer term, I think the super committee, there was a hope from a lot of people and business leaders that the super committee would start to lay the groundwork for what principles and choices our country is going to face to avoid a fiscal crisis like those we see enveloping Greece and lots of countries in Europe today. That's a ways away, but that date is approaching for the United States. The aging population and the ongoing increases in healthcare costs mean the United States is going to face some hard fiscal choices. And I think the super committee not coming out able to have an agreement among these 12 Republicans and Democrats about a basic framework makes it more of an open question when we're going to have the leadership that's going to provide that framework for the country.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned what's happening in Europe. And Eugene Sterley, to you, John E. Sununu, former congressman and U.S. senator from New Hampshire, wrote an article in the Boston Globe saying, across the Atlantic, the crisis in Europe continues to undermine banks, take down governments, threaten the EU itself. America is not Europe, we keep hearing. He says, well, sure, but the super committee did nothing, not even the tiniest thing to affirm that statement. Can we make that analogy that we're going down Europe's road, Eugene?
Well, there are a lot of similarities. In both places, debt has been rising very rapidly relative to our economy, and it's scheduled to rise rapidly even if we restore economic growth. But what's interesting, and Matt alluded to this in his comments, is and you alluded in your question, is the long-run issue of getting this rising debt under control and the short-run issue about how to deal with the stagnating economies both here and in Europe have sort of merged into one issue, even though they don't necessarily require the same solution. So it makes it, just in economic terms, even if we didn't have the partisanship that Matt Laszlo talked about, we would have some tough economic issues to deal with in any case.
All right. And we'll untangle what you just said, Eugene, after a very short break. More questions for both of you. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We're going to take a short break. Afterwards, we'll start taking your calls. The number 1-800-892-6477. Emails are welcome. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, launching the new MBA in Strategic Leadership in January. Information at nec.edu. And from Anselin Anderson Trust and Estate Attorneys, helping families navigate through probate following the loss of a loved one. On the web at Ansel and Anderson in Bedford. More on Back to the Deficit Drawing Board on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, The American Dream. New Hampshire weather for today, a mix of sun and clouds for most of the state, highs 55 to 60, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the North Country, highs 50 to 55. For tonight, mostly cloudy statewide with a chance of showers in the North Country, lows from 40 to 45 north, 45 to 50 for the rest of the state. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what next? After the Congressional Super Committee failed to reach a compromise on deficit reduction, let's get your questions and comments into our conversation. Call in 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. As Congress reconvenes, what do you think the next step should be now that the Super Committee has failed to reach agreement on deficits? And do you think this failure shows that we'll never get our fiscal house in order? Or will the lack of agreement spark Congress to get back together and hammer out some kind of a plan? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests are Matt Slaughter. He's a professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, and Eugene Sterley, fellow at the Urban Institute and a former Treasury Department official during four administrations. And Eugene, back to you. Just before the break, we were talking about short-term and long-term impacts of this lack of agreement on deficits. What about the debt? What sparked this agreement was the debt, the U.S. debt getting downgraded by one of the rating agencies, caused a big crisis this past summer. Did the debt get threatened, the debt rating, get threatened by this lack of agreement?
I don't know whether the ratings got threatened any more by this lack of agreement than they would be anyway. My sense is that the debt ratings would go down if Congress actually abandoned the backup rules they have in place about certain cuts in defense and domestic spending and did nothing else. Now, I want to be clear, nobody really expects those particular cuts to go into place. They're draconian, and in many ways they don't make much sense. But we have had a history in the past of enacting often somewhat silly rules, but that at least held Congress's feet to the fire, and it at times has replaced those silly rules with somewhat better ones. That's sort of a hope, but I would say that the hope is that this doesn't take place probably till after the presidential election.
Wow. So back up, Eugene, and Matt Slaughter, I want to hear from you too. Eugene, no one expects these automatic cuts to go into place, really? No one?
Well, you could probably put into place, you might be able to put in the first year's worth of cuts, but they're across the board. They're not designed to fix any particular program. My experience in government, and I'm sure Matt's was exactly the same, is that, you know, from administration to administration, 80% of the proposals you get out of a place, say like the executive office or the Office of Management Budget, they're the same from Democratic to Republican administrations. That is, a lot of these programs are very inefficiently and very badly run, and there are a lot of fixes that we know we could undertake to make them better. Those fixes still will hurt certain constituencies, and so they're politically difficult. So the hope is that you go to doing the fixes that make sense, but these across-the-board fixes don't. They're just, let's just cut everything haphazardly.
Matt, what do you think?
So Eugene, I think, is really right when he talks about fixes that don't make sense. What I think we need to keep in mind is we need fiscal stability in the United States, not just because, but in part to try to support growth of jobs and incomes in the United States. The context really matters here. The United States is still struggling with this jobs crisis. We have about 109.5 million private sector jobs in the U.S. today, and that's the same number that we had 12 years ago. So part of what hopefully is going to appear in the United States in our fiscal conversations is how we're going to have spending choices and where we're going to raise tax revenue from in a way that supports growth of income and jobs in the United States. So that gets to things like, do you want to tax income or do you want to maybe tax consumption a little bit more? And also there's important issues of supporting investments for the future in contrast to some defense priorities and the entitlement programs of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So I think Eugene's exactly right. Some fixes hopefully are sounder than others, but we need some leadership to frame the trade-offs for the country and try to put forward the priorities that will guide what choices we'll make in the coming years.
So businesses see uncertainty in Washington, Matt, and does that make them uncertain about hiring, or do they see a connection there at all?
It definitely does. If you look at ongoing surveys of both large globally engaged companies and the small and medium-sized businesses in America, they continue to report unusually high levels of uncertainty in the United States about a lot of policy issues. And there's always going to be some uncertainty about what happens in Washington and other governments for these companies. But the range and degree of uncertainty, it's striking how many business leaders cite that as a really important constraint on their investment and hiring decisions in America today. So there's a really important connection there with, if we really think nothing substantive will happen until after the 2012 elections, which means we're into 2013, that's 16 months or more where all businesses in America are thinking, I'm not sure what my corporate tax rate is going to be, the payroll tax for workers I'm thinking of hiring, my personal tax rate for small businesses. All that stuff inhibits growth of these companies.
Well, and Matt, I asked Eugene earlier about whether it's fair to make the connection between the debt crisis in Europe and what we see emerging here in the United States. What do you think? Fair comparison or not?
It's a little more fair than I'd like for comfort. One of the things history shows quite clearly is a financial crises for sovereign debtors, they tend to come a little unexpectedly, meaning creditors around the world are happy to buy government's debt, and they tend to have quite low interest rates. And then, quite unexpectedly, an event or series of events can transpire where suddenly interest rates rise a lot because a lot of the creditors aren't as comfortable holding that country's debt. I think Italy in the past few weeks is a very good example. Italy for a long time has had a high debt-to-GDP ratio, a bit higher than the United States. No one really thought it was an immediate crisis, but then in the past couple of weeks, all of a sudden, Italian interest rates rose above 7% for a lot of their key bonds, and the government of Berlusconi fell. I'm hoping we're not going to have that in the United States, but history shows time and again that's oftentimes how these debt crises play out.
Well, and that makes me just want to step back for a minute with both of you gentlemen. And Eugene, to you first. Okay, so the federal government has run deficits before. I mean, you were involved as a Treasury official in four past administrations. So why are these so worrisome now? Again, deficits being the annual amount of spending versus revenue, debt being the debt that piles up each year that you overspend. Go ahead, Eugene.
Well, we're at what really is a unique period in all of our fiscal history. We've had profligate Congresses before, that is, we've run deficits that were too large before, but typically they were too large in one year. And then the next question was, well, is Congress going to enact legislation that's going to make them very large in future years? What we've now put into place, and both parties are clearly responsible for that, is we've put into place sets of provisions that automatically would make deficits huge in the future, even if Congress never came in and voted on anything. Now, that's partly the entitlements to which Matt has already spoken about, because health and retirement, the largest parts of the entitlement budget, are dominating the budget. And it's not just their size, it's their automatic growth. And then on the flip side, on the tax side, we've kept taxes lower than they've been for decades. So we're not even willing to pay our current bills. So this attempt to control the future by both political parties is really unique, and that's why we have long-run deficit problems that are out of the ordinary from any experience we've had in the past. So let me just give you a quick analogy. Debt rose very rapidly in World War II, but if you look at what was scheduled to take place after World War II, was the spending was going to be reduced, right, because the troops were coming home. But the taxes were also raised a little bit in World War II on a permanent basis to pay for the temporary increase in debt. So you had in place a lot of provisions that were going to bring the debt down automatically as long as future Congresses didn't enact too much new legislation. And that's gone. Now Congress has to rescind past promises for growth in these entitlement programs, past promises it's going to keep taxes so low they're not going to pay our current bills. And that's what's so hard for them politically.
So the structure, Eugene, now that's in place, is that even if Congress went home and never came back, the structure that it has put in place in terms of taxes and spending mean that these deficits and ultimately the debt are just going to continue to skyrocket unless some dramatic change is made.
That's right. In 2009, for the first time in our nation's history, if Congress never had stepped in the door and enacted a single piece of legislation, it was already running deficits. That is, the so-called entitlements are mandatory or automatic part of the government. The spending there was already in excess of all the revenues the government collected, and that's unique. In the past, Congress had to come in and vote for something before the spending started exceeding the revenues that were taking place.
So what's it going to take, Matt? I mean, who's going to provide a way out from all this? Who's going to step up and be a leader and pull us out?
That's the $64,000 question.
Right.
I think, you know, we've had some admirable efforts. The Bull-Simpson Commission, I think, is a model for articulating a set of principles to say we'd like to have tax and spending policies that tend to support economic growth. You know, they articulated some principles in saying we're going to favor some investments for the future for the young, investments in infrastructure and education, and that means trimming in some places some of the growth and entitlement spending. So there are many voices, and earlier in the show we discussed how Senators Ayotte and Shaheen and Representative Bass have articulated a desire to have a broader conversation. My hope is there'll be leaders in U.S. government and citizens and business leaders that can coalesce and provide a narrative for making these choices. The alternative, unfortunately, we see playing out on the streets of Athens and Madrid and other countries in Europe in real time today. Just the reality is, Eugene's exactly right, that the ongoing spending and tax choices that we have in law right now, combined with an aging population and rising healthcare costs, that will force change from the outside in the future as our international creditors at some point decide they're very worried about holding U.S. government debt. I hope we don't get there, but that's the alternative if we don't have the leaders come from within the United States.
Well, and go ahead.
Can I add something here? It's not just leadership on what, and I think Matt and I would probably agree on a lot, if not most items, but it's also leadership on how. And for instance, when this debt commission was set up, it was actually set up to fail. The appointees to the debt commission, for instance, were people who had voted against the very Simpson-Bowles commission that Matt mentioned, that was that tried to have success. So one criterion for getting on this new commission that Congress appointed was that you voted against past efforts to get at this debt. So, and there's a whole variety of other reasons why this commission was not designed well to succeed. So when we're looking for leadership, leadership has to be around not just what we're going to do, but how we're going to make it happen. You know, we can decide to go to battle, but you still want some generals that are going to figure out where to put the troops.
Well, and who are those generals, Eugene?
Well, I think some of it has to begin with the president. And this is not to say that the current president is any worse or better than, say, the past president or past presidents. It's just some leadership has to take place in the White House. I personally don't believe you can organize good government through committees, just like you can't really design a building by having 50 people on the street decide what they want or they don't want. 50 people on the street can vote for it. They should vote for whether they want the building or not, but you hope you get some plumbers and engineers and architects and other people to put a structure in place that's going to stand.
Right. What do you think, Matt?
I'd echo that. I think hopefully leadership from the White House and from all in Congress. I think Eugene was exactly right. The structure and choice of the super committee members, no disrespect, they put in a lot of time and effort. But at some basic level, I'd like all of our representatives and senators to be involved in this conversation. And to some extent, the leadership's going to have to come from us as voters. I mean, we are going to have to demand this of our elected officials in Washington. Again, if we don't, the alternative is the spending and tax path that we're on will continue. And this is where globalization really matters. Because our country doesn't save very much in the aggregate, increasingly the debt that our government is issuing is being bought and held by international creditors. And they're the ones that historically are much more likely to run or at least walk away from a country's debt when they start to get more concerned. So it's got to be citizens as well.
Remember that one reason this super committee failed was that the members felt that success, economic success as we're defining it, would mean political failure. That
wow.
they feel the voters would punish them more for acting than for not acting.
Well,
and hopefully that dynamic has to change.
Right.
And that's a great point. How exactly, we'll see. But
our phone number here again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Eugene Sterley and Matthew Slaughter. We're looking at what may happen now after the super committee failed just before Thanksgiving to reach agreement on $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction. Our number for you to join us about what you would like to see happen next is 1-800-892-6477. Emails are welcome, exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I've received a couple emails. Here's one that we received from the American Friends Service Committee saying it's time to give thanks. Monday, the super committee announced its members were unable to agree on a plan making deficit reductions. They never took seriously our demands for substantial cuts in military spending, could not muster a majority who favored raising taxes on the wealthy and the corporations they own. On the other hand, they were giving consideration to proposals that would have taken big bites out of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. By early November, there was little prospect for a deal that was both fiscally and morally sound. They conclude by saying, in the end, no deal was definitely better than a bad deal. Eugene Sterley, this is what we're hearing from progressive groups, that they didn't like what the super committee was doing, and hallelujah, there's no deal.
Well, this is tough. I think the budget is so badly balanced that we all have to be parties to the to solving the problem. So government today, if you just take total federal spending and you divide it by a number of households, it's about $31,000 a household. And you take total government taxes and you divide it by a number of households, it's about $19,000. So the gap between the spending and the taxes is so huge that every part of the budget has to be affected. So the American Friends Service Committee is exactly right. Defense is going to have to be affected. I think taxes on the wealthy are going to have to be affected. But let's be clear about it. This automatic growth that is taking place in health and retirement programs is something that has to be contained. So there we're not really talking so much about cutting benefits as cutting the growth rate of benefits, which is a very important part of the issue and has to be dealt with as well.
Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Thanks for that email. The email address, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to Tamworth. Paul's waiting on the line. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My comment is that I don't think it is that hard. I think that there are a series of relatively modest actions, as shown in the Simpson bill that was done last year at the Simpson Committee, to change things like payroll taxes now, change amounts to Social Security, change retirement to Social Security a little bit, roll back some of the Bush tax cuts, and you're there. I don't think it's going to take revolutionary change. I think it's evolutionary, and I think that it's been defined as revolutionary, and I don't think it is that.
Paul, thanks for calling in. Matthew Slaughter, what do you think?
So Paul makes a good point, which is, and it echoes what Eugene said a moment ago, if there's lots of adjustments that are made, given how large the federal budget is and given time, the cumulative impact of savings can be quite big. So take Social Security as an example. I think a lot of the current estimates are, given the laws on the books right now, the shortfall over the next several decades in Social Security of payments that will go out relative to Social Security taxes taken in is in the neighborhood of $10 to $12 trillion. Now, that's a lot of money to you and me today, but over many years, that closing that gap is not all that hard if you have a combination of a bit of an increase in the retirement age at some point, and especially if you start to means test recipients for Social Security. So high income, high net worth individuals get a smaller amount of Social Security. You can do some things with indexing, the cost of living increase that goes up every year. That some combination of those things, it's not that hard in terms of the math to close the gap in Social Security. I think a lot of what we're discussing here is the challenge is not so much in the math as it is in articulating the principles and the practice and where the leaders are going to come from to articulate that to get that done. Because one of the things that's clear is every year that goes by where we don't make progress on this, the magic of compound interest or the compelling math of compound interest means the decisions we're going to have to make in the future will have to be a lot bigger.
Well, and I'm glad Paul raised what's been called Simpson Bowles, the commission appointed by President Obama, chaired by former Republican Senator Alan Simpson, and Erskine Bowles, a former Clinton official. And Matthew Slaughter, real quick, some are saying on Capitol Hill, hey, let's revive this thing, just like our caller Paul is saying.
I think it would be great. I think that's a great framework to start from, in part because it forces a bit of tax increase and a bit of spending reductions or slowing the rate of growth for a lot of stakeholders in the United States. But again, what's a little frustrating is they issued that report about 1 year ago, and in terms of the policy process, nothing happened with it.
All right. Well, Paul, thanks a lot for calling in. And after a short break, we'll take more of your calls. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. The email exchange at nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
You might not realize just how many moving pieces there are in NHPR's coverage of primary night. John Forcucci, NHPR's Vice President of News and Digital Media, pulls back the curtain.
We're watching all of the returns, getting information from the camps, what's happening that we want to get on the air right away, and how do we post that information to the web and to social media.
John describes it as an army of people to keep all these pieces moving in sync for excellent coverage on January 10th. Now you know.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, from Lars Heating Systems, manufacturing boilers and water heaters for homes and commercial buildings for over 60 years. Built in New Hampshire with pride. Information at laars.com. And from the New Hampshire Association for the Blind, helping New Hampshire residents live better with vision loss. Information online at sightcenter.org. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a new presidential primary series begins. We call it Issue Tuesday, examining where the presidential candidates stand on those topics important to voters this year. Tomorrow, we kick it all off with where the candidates stand on job creation. Email us your questions and comments before the program to exchange@nhpr.org, and be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're looking at the implications, both political and economic, of the Supercommittee's failure last week to reach an agreement on deficit reduction. We're looking at what happens now. You can join our conversation. Call in 1-800-892-6477. As Congress gets back together this week, what do you think the next step should be now that the Supercommittee is done with its work and has failed to reach agreement? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email us exchange@nhpr.org. And Eugene Sterley, Matthew Slaughter, let's go right back to our callers. Eric's waiting in Hopkinton. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. One next step might be to have the Senate pass a budget. I don't believe it has. The last few terms, the House passed the Ryan budget. I don't think the Senate's dealt with that, nor has it passed its own budget. I'd like your guest to comment.
Yeah, it's a good point, Eric. And it has been pointed out, Eugene Sterley, that President Obama came up with a budget. The House came up with a budget. The Senate hasn't done much of anything on this. He's right. What do you think, Eugene?
Well, I think, Paul, Eric's exactly right. There are process issues, I think, that we also have to deal with about how we can get Congress to enact budgets. It hasn't enacted budgets in most of the recent years. There's all sorts of issues that has to do with the way they report on the budget. There are issues as to what the president submits and whether he should have to submit something that's at least balanced over the economic cycle. The rule having to do with these defense and discretionary cuts that are supposed to start taking place in some draconian fashion is an example of a process in place, but not one that works very well. It would have been worthwhile for the super committee to have devoted some attention to these process issues as well. And some of them get fairly technical, so I'm not going to go into all the details, but I think Eric's is exactly right. You have to pay attention to process, not just to substance.
What do you think, Matthew?
I agree with both Eric and Eugene, and I'll make the connection with businesses. I think you can see quotes. Again, you look at surveys of leaders of all sides businesses. It's these types of process things that are at least as frustrating for business leaders in the United States as the longer-term challenges are. And the reality is what that means is in the coming months and quarters, these business leaders, because of these process failures of not passing a budget, the business leaders don't quite know what's going to be the payroll tax rate that they're thinking about for hiring some people. They don't know what's going to be their business tax rate. And that is a key force feeding into why a lot of these firms are holding back on hiring and capital investment and why the recovery in the United States remains so fragile.
Thanks for that call. And let's take another one. Judith waiting in Bedford. Hi, Judith. You're on the air. Go ahead. Judith, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
My concern is now that the super committee has failed in its work and we're looking for new leaders to try to help solve the problems of our country, are the voters, myself included, just going to be focusing on let's get somebody to solve the problem without looking at the overall impact of how we choose our leaders and what does it mean down the road? I felt that sometimes so many people put so much hope in one leader, Barack Obama, without realizing the larger picture that one individual can't do this. So that's my question. How do you think this is going to affect people's selection of candidates and who they vote for in the election?
Yeah, and Judith, can I ask you a question? I'm real interested.
Yes.
You know, lots of people are saying, let's elect leaders who will work in a bipartisan way and who will solve this, you know, scary deficit and debt problem. And yet when you get into the details, people say, oh, no, you know, don't increase my taxes or, oh, no, don't cut Medicare or Social Security any further. What do you think about that? In theory, voters, Judith, say they want bipartisan agreement, but when you get down to the nitty gritty, they say, no, I can't deal with that.
I think it goes back to that old saying that people vote their pocketbook. And so, that of course, you want the problem solved, but you don't want it to be at any inconvenience to yourself.
All right. Judith, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Eugene?
Well, I think Judith's exactly right. But let me give you a little story. A couple years ago, I met with a number of leaders from both Republican and Democratic who really wanted to work on making a budget deal. And there was a period of time during this discussion where basically several members basically said, you know what, if I take a stand against any constituency, I'm going to get slaughtered. That constituency, be it veterans or older people or higher income people who don't pay taxes, as soon as something's proposed that's going to take something away from them or make them pay more taxes, they come into my district or they come into my state and they put on huge advertisements and they advertise against me. A lot of the advertisements aren't even accurate, and nobody comes in on the opposite side. So unfortunately, I don't have the answer to Judith's question, but the simple fact is that we voters are appealed to at a very crass level about what's in our self-interest and what's not in our national interest, and that has to stop. But it's going to take a real turnaround, I think, in the way we've been conducting elections for some time.
Well, and I'm guessing you wrote about this, Eugene, in your column that's online, The Government We Deserve. Sounds like there's some echoes there.
So yes. I wish I had the answer for Judith. In some ways, we have to be more educated voters. It's not just a bad Congress or weak members of Congress or a president that's the wrong one in office. It's also the question of what we voters expect and what we demand.
Well, Judith, thanks a lot for that call. And our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Andrew who says, your guests aren't being any more fair than most of these types of conversations because they are not willing to lay the blame where the bulk of it belongs. Andrew says, almost every single Republican legislator has actually taken a pledge to not just refuse to raise taxes, but also not to raise revenues. We cannot balance the budget with just spending cuts for both mathematical reasons and political ones. And Andrew concludes by saying, only Democrats, including Obama, have acknowledged this. What do you think, Matt Slaughter?
So I think that, especially if we're looking ahead to the future, I'm not sure blame is the right word. I think the challenge we face as a country is simply we've got an aging population and we've got projected increases in healthcare costs that, like earlier decades, are going to be far above cost increases for lots of other things. Those are the two basic drivers of the fiscal mess that America is approaching in the coming generation. Now, how we address that, I'm a longstanding independent. We can think about how we want to try to have revenue increases be part of the solution, but revenue increases that are ways that support the growth in jobs and incomes that a lot of us need. As Judith said in the earlier call rightly, people do vote their pocketbook and people are worried around the kitchen table these days. So we can think about raising taxes rather than just doing it by increasing marginal rates on corporations and high-income individuals. We can think about trying to broaden the tax base by doing things like eliminating certain deductions that a lot of Americans receive for charitable deductions, for payments of mortgage interest if they have a mortgage on their home, for employer-provided health care. And I realize a lot of people may hear that and say, wow, I don't want to lose those benefits. I understand that, but there's got to be some way that we increase tax revenues that addresses the trade-offs of how much do we want to support economic growth versus some other goals that we have in this country.
You know, Eugene, I'd like to hear from you, too. And adding into Andrew's complaint about Republican lawmakers, he says, you know, wouldn't budge on revenues. Democrats said there was a 13th member on the supercommittee, Grover Norquist, the founder and president of Americans for Tax Reform. They say that Republican hands were tied and that they had agreed to be tied by Grover Norquist and his No New Taxes pledge. What do you think about Andrew's critique and the critique from the left that Republicans went into this saying no to a big, what could have been a big part of deficit reduction?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that Republicans are afraid of Norquist and the No Tax pledge. And there's certain aspects of the pledge that that really absolutely make no sense, even from a conservative standpoint. The tax code is just full of all sorts of items that are just like spending. So, for instance, let's take higher education. We have subsidies for higher education through Pell Grants and direct spending, but we also have several now subsidies in the tax system that come across as tax reductions. They operate almost the same way. They have roughly the same economic effect. Administratively, they're a mess because there's so many of them, and some people don't even know how they can apply for them, and schools don't always know how to mix them together even to apply them fairly. So taking a stand against reducing some of those spending items in the tax code while taking a stand in favor of reducing spending items that are in the direct spending budget just doesn't make any sense at all. But that also just shows you how rhetoric dominates this debate. So if that's a tax increase, getting rid of spending hitting the tax code, then what can you do? And you may remember much earlier in the conversation, your correspondent, also named Matt, mentioned that Republicans, at least some Republicans, said they were willing to deal with revenues as opposed to taxes. And what they're hinting at is that they're willing to go after some of these spending items hidden in the tax code, even though they might not favor increases in tax rates.
So they'd make changes in the tax code, getting rid of loopholes, exemptions, and so forth, but not repealing those Bush tax cuts from almost 10 years ago that are always coming up in this debate, Eugene.
Well, not all the Bush tax cuts were tax rates either. So let's be clear. But you know, again, that'd be sort of a silly stand. We're gonna reduce the child credit, but we're gonna keep the tax rates lower on the rich. I don't think that's gonna be a selling point for any party. So there's basically both parties run into the dilemmas of their rhetoric. Their rhetoric at times is totally contradictory. But I think it's fair to say, just to go beyond your previous caller, that neither party really has an agenda for moving forward into the future, which was what Matt Slaughter and I were trying to get to, is how can you really reorient the budget to be much more focused on investment and moving towards the future? And neither party has really addressed that issue to any great extent.
Even though, Matt, some members of Congress, again, did say, hey, look, this really gives us the incentive that we need to move ahead in a serious way on this debt and deficit problem. You agree with Eugene that neither party really has an agenda or an incentive to move forward that way?
I do, at least not a broad enough one that we're getting a substantive change in the political discussion and in the actual process and policies we're putting into place. The paradox, I think, on Eugene's insight is there's this great opportunity for every member of Congress or every person that aspires to be in the White House. And I think it's just that great leaders don't just respond to public opinion. Great leaders shape public opinion. And I know that that's a challenge, but boy, the individuals one of our earlier callers rightly pointed out, this is going to be a conversation the United States has for a long time, I think. This isn't something we can resolve in a month or even in 1 year. There's such an opportunity for a set of leaders to help shape the public opinion and help us make the choices that's going to support a lot of families in America and support the broader goals of the United States and the world. I'd actually add one thing, if I could, on this that's important is fiscal issues matter for Americans' pocketbooks, but they also matter for the United States' place in the world and for broad issues of national security. And the one example I'll give is a couple of weeks ago when EU officials were scrambling to try to stem the crisis that's continuing there, a lot of officials said we're going to increase by €1 trillion this thing called the European Financial Stability Fund. And the government officials there said, we hope to be able to come up with €1 trillion. We don't have the resources here among our member countries. And what was very telling was the government officials in Europe then got on some airplanes, and they didn't come to the United States. Where they went to was to Beijing, China, because they acknowledged the reality that our fiscal problems today mean we can't provide much help to support Europe's fiscal problems today. But instead, they went to one of these rising economic powers in the world, China.
So this has a real impact on the U.S.'s position as a world leader.
It absolutely does.
You know, you mentioned leadership, Matt, and Eugene, I don't want to leave without asking you about your time. As I said, you spent lots of time in the Treasury Department during four different administrations, but you played a leadership role in the Reagan tax reforms in 1986, the last time we had real broad, serious tax reform in this country. What lessons can you pull from that, Eugene, that might inform us as we wade through this mud today?
Well, one I mentioned earlier, which was that I do think you have to gather together some people who understand how to build the building. I don't mean that they don't present alternative designs that both parties might want to vote for, but you still want to make sure that the substructure and the superstructure are in place, the building's going to stand, you know, the light comes through the windows, the plumbing works. I think you have to start at that level, and I think a lot of these committees don't. I think you have to set up a process where people are held accountable. Interestingly enough, and I won't go into all the details, at every stage of tax reform, there was somebody accountable, and when failure looked like it was going to happen, they started looking bad. This was the Ways and Means Chairman, the Senate Finance Chairman, and the Treasury Secretary at times. So you need to have a way of holding people accountable. And you do have to have some bipartisan agreement that you're going to share in the glory of success. And Reagan, President Reagan, and Dan Rostenkowski, who was head of the Ways and Means Committee at the time, did reach one of those types of agreements. So there are a lot of pieces that one has to put into place to make it happen. At the end of the day, of course, the leaders have to want to make it happen. They have to want to make it happen that even if there's a huge political price to pay, they're willing to pay it for the good of the country.
What do you think, Matt Slaughter? What are the chances those pieces that Eugene talks about will be put in place? Leave us with a little optimism here, Matt.
Yeah, no, the chances aren't zero, which is great. And there's a lot of voices on both sides of the aisle that are talking about a desire to make that happen. We've got time in the United States. That's the other fortunate thing. The fiscal woes that face our country, they're not as imminent as they are for many other countries around the world. So that's a couple of good things. But it's going to require some of these leaders to really reach across the aisle and even within their own parties to say we need to set aside the partisanship and the blame, and we need to find some new narratives that's going to guide the kind of choices our countries need to make on how we're going to raise some revenue, how we're going to limit spending in a way that puts the country on a sustainable fiscal trajectory, in a way that ultimately supports families' incomes in America and the broader political and military and strategic goals the country has in the world.
What do you think, Eugene? How optimistic are you?
I'm going to make a prediction here, which is always dangerous for economists.
Go ahead.
The notion for economists is we should either give the amount or the date, but never both. So you're never proven to be wrong. But I would say in 2013, regardless of what happens this year, 2012, in 2013, the first major initiative of whoever's elected president will be on these budget issues. It won't be enough. As Matt said, I think this is an issue that we're going to have to deal with for years. We've taken decades to get to this situation. I think it's going to take us time to get out of it, but I think it's going to be the major initiative that we see in 2013. And if you think about it from an optimistic standpoint, 1 year ago, 2 years ago, we weren't even talking about this issue in the same way. We were talking about how to spend ever more cut taxes ever more. And the tide has already turned in terms of the discussion,
okay,
not in terms of the action. So I'm optimistic.
All right. Eugene, thanks a lot for being with us. We sure appreciate it.
Enjoyed it.
Eugene Sterley, he's a fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington. Matthew Slaughter, good to have you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Laura.
Matthew Slaughter, he's a professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer today is Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.